The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Carol Phillips Memorial Lecture. My name is Andy Greenberg. I'm a former member of the Library Board of Directors. This lecture is held in memory of my mother, who is a great supporter of the library and is one of a number of endowed lectures that honor supporters and friends of the Free Library. Now, as you saw in the short video aired before tonight's program, the Free Library carries out critical work each and every day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity in the Philadelphia region. It's a cornerstone of democracy and a driver of educational, cultural, and economic advancement. If you value the Free Library as much as we do, please consider making a gift of support through the Library's Foundation. The Foundation makes possible many of the Library's incredible programs, like tonight's author event. Visit freelibrary.org to learn more. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's authors. For 20 years of marriage, James Carville and Mary Madeline have reigned as the country's most politically divergent, ideologically mismatched, and intensely opinionated couple. Often referred to as the Raging Cajun for his animated and colorful style, Carville is a Democratic strategist who serves as a political contributor for CNN. James is no stranger to Philadelphians. A number of us got to know him in 1986 when he came up north to take on the gubernatorial campaign of Bob Casey Sr. James was the high-voltage force who led Casey's campaign to victory, and I might say Pennsylvania politics have not been the same since. Madeline was the media-savvy Republican strategist for two Bushes and one Cheney. In two distinct voices, James and Mary's spirited new memoir, Love and War, follows the couple's story from the end of the 1992 presidential campaign, where he managed Bill Clinton's triumph while she suffered defeat, through the Clinton era, through George W. Bush's presidency, the election of Barack Obama, and the rise of the destructive partisanship that dominates Washington today. Mary and James will be interviewed tonight by Dick Pullman, a writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania and a national political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mary Madeline James Carville and Dick Pullman.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Dick Pullman. You know who these guys are. We have a full house tonight, and so I also want to welcome the people in the overflow room upstairs. The way this works, for those of you who've been here before, would know this, of course. We're going to talk just for about a half an hour, some conversation, some questions I had boned up on, and then we're going to turn it over to questions from the audience. Save them up. Make them in forms of questions and not speeches, as you probably heard that before. And I'm sure these guys aren't going to do speeches either. We're going to get right to it. I think the first question has to be the question that they're probably most tired of answering. Maybe I can say it in a new way that hasn't been said before, but I'm sure it's on the minds of many here, particularly in spouses who talk politics, which is that how do two people with such diametrically opposite political views manage to keep it all together for 20 years? And by the way, let's celebrate that it's their 20th wedding anniversary in last November. So James and Mary, whoever wants to go first, the question really is, how do you do it?
Well, the older we get, the easier it is, because he can't hear and I never did listen. So that that kind of works. And also at age 60, when I say I'm out of estrogen and I have a gun, that works too. But I really want to start out, James can answer, however he wants to answer. He is the seriously most romantic, sexy guy I've ever, well, obviously I married him, but when we were first dating, he was working in Philadelphia. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about this. And I would get on that darn train every Friday night, and he would meet me at the train station every Friday night. He'd be there at the top of the stairs, and was so excited to see me. And then he'd go do the campaign for the next 48 hours, and I didn't see him. But it was the thought of it that he was romantic for the hour that whatever it took him to get me from the train station. So I guess I just carry that Philadelphia memory for 20 years.
Yeah, that was in the Wofford campaign in 1991. We actually met in 1991 and was living here. And our first campaign I did here was 1986. I was in Philadelphia. I remember Frank Rizzo holding court at the 15th Street Bookbinders. I mean, that's how long I've been around this joint. First of all, thank Free Library. Thank Dick. And I got to see a lot of my friends out here. I'm not going to start recognizing them. But I love coming here. It's an important part of our relationship. When I would sit at the top of, coming up the escalator from the train from Washington. And, what I always tell people, people get married to different religions, or some people are atheists, married devout people, or this and that, or you got people that get married and they have children from a previous marriage and they hate each other's kids. And God knows there's all kinds of people that hate the in-laws. So it's easier to be married to a woman that hates your politics and hates your mother, I mean, what the hell?
Well, can I borrow your pen? Do you mind?
Sure.
I'm actually going to note that down. You don't need it. I'm the one who needs the pen. I noticed in the book, one of the things that I saw a number of times in the book was, and you mentioned it, both of you mentioned it in different ways, was just that you're working in politics all day long through a lot of these years. And so actually, you know what each other thinks about key issues. And by the time you get home, and for the sake of the marriage, and you have a lot of other things going on, you just agree not to talk about it a lot of the time. I mean, you probably phrase it in a different way in the book, but that's the gist of it a lot. Is that you? It's not like you sit there and talk politics all the time. There's a lot else going on, so you don't engage in it.
Yes. Well, not least of which, it is weird to get married at age 40 and 49. The reason his mother loved me so much before she passed, is because I was the first girl he brought home that was of age. So
we had another George Clooney here.
We had a head start there. But I was 40, he was 49. I got accidentally pregnant at age 40. We weren't planning that. Who gets accidentally pregnant? Well, then I had another one at 40, another one at 45. Then I went to the White House. I mean, then his mother had Alzheimer's, and that was a trial for the family. My father had multiple myeloma. That was a trial. His baby brother died on the way to our house. I mean, it's like we have a family. There are other things. We're not going to sit around and fight about the minimum wage. And now, in the past couple of years, we've had two teenage daughters. So there's nothing. Maybe a rock, okay, but I would say it was a teenage girl's and a rock in that order.
Yeah, I just make an observation. It's something I noticed that because I was like 48 before I was James Carville. I was something else in the other life. If you stop and you think about it, if somebody is known, you only know that person for that. They're not a parent, they're not a son, they don't have other interests, they don't get sick, they don't do anything that happens to other people. You just, that's that political guy on TV. And that's the only, and people sort of know, that's Mike Schmidt. All he is a baseball player. It's the only thing that you know is about a famous person is that thing that they are famous for. Okay? Like, Jim Brown is here tonight, who is Senator Casey's chief of staff, was Governor Casey's chief of staff. Jim and I have been knowing each other since 1986. If I talk to Jim 25 hours in a year, 20 hours will be something other than politics. Okay? People, it's sort of hard. So we go, we're involved in the stuff in Louisiana. Something's always happening there. The kids are doing this. Or something's happening at school. I come from a huge family. Somebody's going here. We got to go here. Mardi Gras is coming up. What are we going to, how are we going to schedule this? And then the NBA All-Star game is coming. And everything is sort of, the book is coming out. What is the USA Today review like or whatever? I mean, it's like all of the things that happen in your life happen in our lives. And the sort of temptation is, I teach it too late. I do foreign consulting. I do very little, but some advisory for a tech company out in the Silicon Valley. So I'm just saying, it's really not a great temptation to sit there and argue about at the end of the day when I've been on the phone or doing interviews or talking to this and that. At the kind of end of day when I go to dinner with my wife, I'm not, even if she agreed with everything I did, I wouldn't be that tempted to talk about politics.
But I don't. But also, seriously, because which is one of the motivations for writing this book, the uglier politics got at the national level, the greater the urgency with which we are and frequency with which we are asked that question, like we have some sort of secret thing. We're not a democracy. We're a mamocracy, okay? If mama ain't happy, I'm not domineering in that way. It's just like, what's the point of fighting? We know we're going to disagree. Do you seek out things in your marriage to disagree about? Then get divorced. We're not looking for... We know what we're going to fight over. We learned it pretty quickly, and we avoid that at all costs.
Except you mentioned Iraq a few minutes ago, and I noticed there's an interesting top 10 in the book, in the middle of the book, of the 10 things that you fight about the most. And there were things on there like pets, dare I say, since you put it in the book, potty etiquette was in there. You have to buy the book to see what that's about. But Iraq was on the list as number 6, and it was the only even remotely political related issue in the top 10. And it mentioned in there that it is number 6 down from number 2. So is that because the passions of the war have dissipated and there's absolutely and there's nothing else that's happened in the last four or 5 years to replace it?
We could whip it up to number 1 pretty quick right now. I can go to DEFCON 1 fast. No, because we just fought about it so much for so long, so loudly and so disruptively, that he just said one day, we were driving somewhere and he rolled down the window and he said, it takes two people to fight. I'm not going to talk about this anymore. And he disengaged and we haven't talked about it since.
Yeah, we did. And some things are worth fighting over and arguing over. At least, I wasn't leaving a cap on a toothpaste. At some point, even you gotta, you can fight over something so much. And one of the things that you look, I'll tell people, I'm 69 years old. I'm not changing wives, sexual orientations, or political parties. I'm pretty much stuck with what you got. I mean, I've gone this long. What the hell? We'll just,
romantic.
So, and I'm not, and the other thing is the next thing, she's not going to change. And what the hell? Move on.
I think it was actually, I thought one of the things in there that seemed like you had more attention to in the book about clashing was on when you would say, this is referring to furniture in the house, and he would say, is that new? And you'd say, correct me if I'm wrong, you'd say, well, it's been in the last five houses that we've lived in, right? So, you know, it's that everyday stuff.
Is that right? New? I've worn that five times, and you've never noticed that. How... Well, here's what happens. I really don't like to fight about this. Yes, it is new, but if I tell them it's new, they're going to have a fight about it. So I pretend like it's not new. And when and you have to get the whole thing done, right? If you any, I love art and period pieces and the architecture of New Orleans is so unique. It's as unique as, you know, if you live in a city like Philadelphia, New Orleans, or there are very few cities in America that have such unique architecture, and to do them right, to do them justice, I taught myself by going to these auctions and all this stuff. So some weird things would appear that he had never seen, like a center hall table. He said, "What is that?" I said, "This is, you know how these old houses, 1904, has a big center hall." I said, "It's a center hall table." He goes, "I can see that sitting right down in the middle of the center of the hall." He says, "What do you?" He goes, "People are going to trip on it." I said, "No, it's like, you know, that's when people, when you have a cocktail party, because we do a lot. We're chairman of the Super Bowl. You know, we do a lot of stuff. We have four events a week. So people stand around, they put their drink." And he goes, "I don't know nobody who puts their drinks down." "Who puts their drinks down? Nobody ever puts their drinks down." So I actually go to the last resort. Well, I got it on sale, which... So... 2 weeks later, I hear him at this party. He goes, "Hey, put your drink down. It's on the center hall table. Mary got it on sale. She'll be very happy about it." So that's how it works.
We were the chairman of the Super Bowl last year when it was in New Orleans a year ago. And that, I don't know what that cost me because, of course, we had to get the house ready for the Super Bowl. Well, that was a 1 year. That was a capital improvements project, Elisa, which I'm not. Could have probably built a turnpike for what that thing cost.
Right. Well, there is one political issue that we have to bring up because you spent that where you did have a major, you had some major tension on, and you spent a lot of time on it in the book, more than on any other by far, which was the aftermath of the 2000 election, which we may remember here, how it took till mid-December in Florida to get that sorted out, and some people probably think it was never sorted out. But you guys had like a major, major disagreement on there. And if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, you said, so this was December of 2000, that it was roughly until around Memorial Day 2001, when you were actually speaking a lot to each other.
Well, there's a conflation of issues. And I think that the review that was it in the Philly paper today?
Probably yesterday.
Yesterday. The political part of the book is the most boring to me, but the publisher said, and our editor said, it'd be weird to just leave it out since I was in the 9/11 White House. The walk up to the recount was so painful because everybody I know and love in politics for 30 years was involved and was in Florida and was working on it, and same with him. So we're sitting in Washington, and I had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, and it's just the emotion. And as if that weren't enough, within 5 minutes of the Supreme Court decision, I got a call from the Cheneys. And within 5 minutes of that, we had a new life. So, good. That's a good place to quit right there. And he did not want me to go back to the into the White House, and I was 47. I had a career. I birthed two babies, made some money, made some decisions. Like, you can't tell me what I'm not going. So it was like this standoff. At finally, at Memorial Week, and his sister is home. I said, we are not talking. By the time this weekend is over, take him back. Take him back.
I feel like I'm marriage counseling. James, is there anything you would like to say to what Marilee just said?
It was a difficult time, and I guess that was like a war's worth. It was, if you're going to argue over something, you know, if you get in a tussle, get over something that's worth it and big. And, you know, we moved on. And I think that the whole, and I wrote about it in the book, that after 9/11, that, you know, was really kind of, I was kind of glad, well, I felt like, gee, our family is doing something, making a contribution. So it, that really changed a lot of the way I look at it. And on that day, I was in Washington actually doing an event, and I found out about it, and I had to get across the Potomac because we live in Alexandria, and my children were in school over there, and I finally got to them. And, you know, if you remember, particularly if you lived in Washington, you didn't know what, you know, planes were going down the mall, and I mean, it was every kind of thing that you can imagine. And I didn't know what was going on at the White House. I didn't know if it was going to be was bombed or whatever. And about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call and says, "Mr. Carville." And I said, "Yes." He said, "This is Major Dickerson, and I am authorized to tell you that your wife is safe and nothing else. Goodbye." And she was in the whatever with the vice president and the whole thing. And so that was one of the most relieved I was. I mean, I knew I had the kids. She couldn't call me. It was a really, a time to have somebody in the middle of all of that. So when that changed my view of things, you know, pretty good bit. But that was it was obviously like most people. The one of the things that kind of thought about doing this book is in the last 20 years, the 22 of us, I told somebody we've been ringside at a lot of things. And somebody said, well, you've kind of been in the ring. But I mean, if you, the whole, the Clinton years, you know, particularly the events surrounding the impeachment and then 9/11, and then, you know, all of this, and then the Katrina reconstruction. I mean, I think back, and we've been very fortunate to have participated in a lot of history. And I thought it was worth, in the book, to talk about some of these things that, as a family, we were able to do. And I mean, in that sense, I mean, I think we're obviously very fortunate. But it was a good... You know, we wrote the book in 1993, and it seemed like, and it'd be another 20 years, I think, before we do another one, which is means that in my term, that's never. But I really do, of anything I've done, I really like this book. I don't know why, just been up. When, you know, I was reading it, you know, you read the books for tape thing, and in the middle of it, I just like, yeah, you know what, And if you don't like the book, I mean, my feelings are not going to be terribly hurt, and you just don't like me. Or, you know, Mary's part is the same thing. And one of my favorites, the review of it was in Philadelphia Magazine or something. Somebody sent me a review here in Philadelphia called, said, "I was a good writer, and Mary was a very good writer." So that's good. I'm cool with that. I'm not really a...
Yeah, that was yesterday's...
It was a nice...
That's because I actually wrote my part. You dictate. No, he is a great writer. Can I say something about, though, because he brought it up, and I think it's why he likes the book and why I like the book, and I really... You know when you do a book and you really are nervous about the reviews and all that? We really... It just came out. And one of the things that came out that speaks to the marriage, this is not a marriage book, but when I was dispatched or called by the mill aides to get down to the PIAC, which is the bunker, and they told us to run for our life, I said, "Are you kidding me? I have 6-inch Charles Jourdain, brand new patent leather, high heels on. I'm walking for my life. I'm not going to..." How dramatic. But, you'll remember that day that our kids' school is right by the Pentagon. I knew James was on the other side of the Potomac. You ask about love and how do we do it? That's where you started. When you read in it, my level, had the level of security that I had, you are not allowed to tell your family when you're going, where you're going, how long you're going to be gone, or any of that, nor you really do you know yourself. I knew at a cellular level that if my husband had to swim across the Potomac, he would get those kids who were in different schools, who were with in proximity to the Pentagon, when we didn't know, all these planes had not been downed yet. I knew he would get my daughters to safety. And when you have that level of primal trust and confidence in a person, I mean, what's to... And he did. I still don't know to this day how he did it because there was no traffic. I don't know if he walked across the bridge or you couldn't move. Everything was just stopped. It wasn't as chaotic as New York, but it was chaos there. And he did it. And I knew he would. It was how I was able to get my work done that day.
So you were going to say?
No.
I was just talking a little bit about the book itself, the process that... That prompts me to just wonder. Then, did you read each other's sections? And did you ever say?
No, I read over a period of time. But as we were doing it, I did our section and she did hers. I mean, we didn't like collaborate and the editor did a good job of like putting it together. I think, and I think it had. Yeah, you know, it's a little disjointed, but there's two different stories and two different people. I mean, you wouldn't want. I don't think the reader really wanted collaboration and us to get together and figure out what it was. I think that when if you read, you want something genuine. You want to know what I think about something. You want to know what she thinks about something. And I don't mind the fact that it doesn't totally sort of make sense as one person wrote it, because one person didn't write it. Two people wrote it. Two different people. Two people with two different views of a lot of different things wrote it. And I think that if the reader didn't get that, I think they would think that there was something dishonest about the book.
You know what we did to our publisher, which is something we do on TV? Don't tell him I said this. We answer the questions we wish we would have been asked rather than the ones that we are. So we just wrote about what we wanted to write about. When the publisher came back and said, you need to answer this or go back and forth. But it is what were the prominent events of the 20 years and our love for New Orleans and what it's like to raise teenagers and how politics fits into all of that. And it is. It reminds me of when we are on TV, when we're not, unless it's, well, Tim, we'd answer Tim's questions, but usually we just answer whatever we wish he would have been asked.
So were you...
Not doing that to
it,
you.
Was it tongue-in-cheek then when you said in the book that you gave just a cursory skimming of your spouse's ravings? That was kind of tongue-in-cheek then, right?
Well, here we are back in Iraq. The reason we do work the way we work, and we have done things together. We've collaborated. James wonderfully went with me to Amman, to Jordan, to train Iraqi women to codify human rights for their constitution. We've done the Ukraine campaigns together. We know how to work together. We can. But when we did our first book, we sat down for the first session. Within 10 minutes, we were screaming at each other. And the collaborator guy was like, forget it. This is not going to work. So we... Martha Sherrill, I don't know if she's a fabulous, brilliant woman reporter from the Washington Post, and Brady Dennis. They rewrite it and they structure it and form it. But I wasn't going to even address Iraq. And then David, the publisher, said, "You have to respond to what he said about Iraq." Well, I couldn't give it more than a cursory raving because I had one going off to college and I had another one going off to boarding school and I had an emotion overload at the point. So that was a cursory
raving. It's a human process.
The other thing I think, it's a lot about home and a lot about like connecting. And I go through, and like anything else in the South, my kind of family, my great-grandfather was a carpetbagger, and we got the records, and was actually a floor leader for Governor Pinchback, who was the African-American Republican governor of Louisiana. He was a Republican. And went through, you know, my whole, as anybody grew up like I did, whole history of the, you know, race and everything else. And then I went back, and people always said Carville is a French name, and I would correct them and say, actually, it's an Irish name. And so we went to Ireland. The summon part of it is, you know, wanted kind of doing things. And so we went, and my cousin Gary Carville is the mayor of Castlevania. And that was right, is in County Monaghan, which is right on the border. You never know when you're in County Armagh. That was the center of the troubles. And actually, it is a French name. They came over to England and Northampton with William the Conqueror. The history is sort of there. Then came to Ireland in the 1700s. And my great-grandfather immigrated at the same time as the potato family. But come to find out, I'd always assumed that it wasn't, because the part of Ireland that we're from wasn't affected by it. And I said, well, why did he leave Ireland and come to the United States? And the guy said, probably too many kids and too few cows. Too few cows, not enough to eat. I mean, that was the Irish way of saying he got hungry. But it was a really very forced me to do things and think about things in a very sort of good way. And before we go to Q&A, because I see so many people here, I want to talk about just politics for a second. And the one thing when the book, we were doing the book, is the publisher, everybody said, don't let it be a political book, because God, just no one wants to read a book about politics now. And people, I love politics. And the thing, and I come here and I say all of my friends is, and the thing I love the most about it is the relationships that you forge. But they're people that I'm still close to this day here in Pennsylvania. 1992 campaign, there are like six or seven of us that talk on the phone four, five, six times a week. And, you know, everything goes through kind of a cycle, if you will. But I have always proud of what I did for a living. Always loved it. Always was glad to be in the middle of it. And some of the best friends and best relationships and best people that I've ever been associated with in my life have been in politics. And we're talking here about, you know, way back in 1986, and Tom Ferrick, who used to cover us for the Enquirer. I remember all that just like it was yesterday. And to the young people, if you have young people, do not discourage them from going into politics. I really wouldn't do that. This is difficult times. I'll agree with that, and all these kinds of things happen. But I wouldn't trade my career for anything in the world. And I'm very proud of, and I'm very proud of what my wife did. I'm very, very proud of her. She was people say, well, she was in our culture, in our world. Political people back then is what we hated was some sniveling person that was trying to play both ends or do something like that. That was a person that was not to be respected. And she's always has, you know, played hard, and she's a believer, and I respect it. I'd rather be married to somebody that thinks differently than I does, that has passion, than somebody that thinks like I do and doesn't have any passion. I would put passion over agreement any day of the week.
Well, speaking of politics and whatever else.
Thank you, honey.
It's nice when it ends all. Do you want to hug now? All right, you can hug later. We're going to take questions from the audience. Please try to keep them as succinct as possible. That way, the most people can get their views in. So, whoever wants to go first, we have people with microphones here.
There you go.
Right here?
There's somebody right back there. Raise your hand there. Look at that young fellow.
So, this question is for James. I was watching Sunday Morning with my mother a couple weeks ago. And you said when you were younger, you were kind of like not necessarily a misfit, but you sort of like weren't the ideal student. You weren't in class. You had a glass in your hand, things like that. Like, the question is, how would you say, or How would you characterize that further than what was on Sunday morning? And when would you say that would change, or how did that change, or how did that influence your life?
How did what, being a bad student?
No, being a bad student, and, you know, like, you said you didn't really go to school, and you kind of...
You went to LSU for 11 years, is what he's saying. How did you become, with a 4.0 on graduation day, which was your blood alcohol level, the person you are today?
You know, one of the things I think is we talked about in the book, and this probably has something to do with my lack of academic power. It's probably a lot to do with drinking and going to the French Quarter and playing cards and, you know, chasing co-eds. I'm going to be honest with you. That probably had something to do with it.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Right. I have was diagnosed. But Mary was like, it was really getting to be a bad thing. But she said, you never pay attention. You're jumping around. You're doing this. I'm in the airport one day, and a guy comes up to me, and he said, Mr. Causey, I said, I'm Dr. So-and-so. I'm the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at, I don't know, Penn Medical School or something like that. And he said, I do not go around diagnosing people. I've just been watching you for the last 10 minutes, and I'm pretty sure you have some attention issues. So my wife and I, we talked about it. We talked about this in the book, and then we went to some high-powered hotshot in, you know, Northwest Washington, and they did a battery of tests and interviews and everything else, and sit down, and I received a formal diagnosis that I'm ADHD, and he said, look, there are drugs that can sort of help with this, and, you know, we talked about it, and, you know, I said, I really don't want to change. Kind of like, and I think it really helped her, because then she understood what was going on. And I've had people, like, that don't know me that think, like, that, you know, that guy just, you're having lunch, he just gets up and walks away. You're saying something, and then he, in the middle of the sentence, he's talking about something else. And then somebody would say, no, he's just kind of like that, kind of weird guy. He just got to get over it. It doesn't mean anything to you about it. I do give I've had to leave. And I give the Marine Corps some credit. I learned how to deal with it. So when I went to law school, I had the right kind of study group, and I was smart enough to go to the smart people who would sort of discuss things, and then I could remember it for the exam. I mean, not like I was on law review or something, but I got through. And I was able to, you know, and I think, too, that, you know, God closes one door, opens another. It probably forced me to think in creative short burst, which was ideal for political campaigning.
Yes, that is why he's a Zen master of sound bites, because he has the attention span of a gnat. But let me say this. How we really got him to the doctor was both both of our daughters have processing issues. I do not think attention deficit disorder is properly named. It is not a deficit. It is not a disorder. I don't know any genius people in history, from Ben Franklin to Thomas Edison to my husband, to my daughters, who aren't geniuses, who it's just the way you process information. You see the world a different way. My daughter the first one couldn't read. She couldn't pay attention. She would write, like she'd start in the middle. She'd write in a circle. She'd write like this. I taught her how to read when she was 6 or 7 by reading Dorothy Parker aloud to her. So we'd go to these parties. We'd take her somewhere, and she goes, well, you can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think. I'm like, oh, my God. All right, well, what you going to do? You got one like that? I'm like, I think they're all three of them are brilliant. And this child who's every bit as crazy as her daddy, it would be considered deficit or disorder, won for the first time in the history of Sacred Heart. She went to the Academy, just graduated from the Academy of Sacred Heart, won the unanimous... She won first place at essay award. Unanimous. It's a blind contest. They didn't know it was her. All the judges unanimously picked her first. She got published as a writer when she was in high school. I mean, so this is not a disorder. This is not a defect. This is a... It is... And his mother called him a toaster. The boy's like a toaster. All he does is pop up. His his mama dragged him through LSU, and his daddy put him in the Marines. But we cannot let kids who don't fit right into the way we think everybody's supposed to learn. We can't let them go.
I hope that answers your question.
Some people will time it in, some people tell you to time, some people tell you, tell you how to make a watch. We tell you how to build a Swiss village.
Yes, sir.
Well, in addition to the rule about answer the question you wish they had asked, there's another one that says don't ever let it get personal. And you folks seem to have learned that lesson. How about the people you deal with? Are they civil to one another? We are dealing with a society that seems to have lost in the political sphere any sense of civility.
Yeah,
we've lost any sense of civility.
Really, I wasn't kidding when I said it is with increasing urgency that people are asking us how do we get a big, because they're seeing it dissipate all around them. James and I have this rule, the green room rule. We hate to talk to people in green rooms before we go on, because once you've talked, your friends, have any kind of acquaintance with somebody, you have to be nice to them. You don't have to, but if you have any civility, we have some issues that are causing great emotion. It's not the first time in the history of this country we've had them. Much of the history of this country in this very vicinity was emotional. But I think there is to us, maybe it's because I'm 60, you really want to spend that much emotion on, they're good people, we both like to light candles. We don't like the curse of darkness. And we're lucky in New Orleans that people are pulling together and they want to work together. It does get poisonous in Washington, but we work on projects together, the energy. I'm not going to go through all of them, but you're right. And I think the answer to it is, do you know that you saw the Gallup poll yesterday or the day before? Fewer and fewer people are identifying with either party, and Republicans have a terrible brand, because Republicans aren't mad at Republicans. I'm mad at Republicans. I think something, if James was a science teacher, believe it or not, so what's a physics concept? Something that cannot be sustained will not be sustained. People just get sick of it, and they'll behave toward the political process in a different way, which our founders envisioned, right? Federalism. It's working at the state, many state levels. It's working in the city levels. I'm a gridlock girl. Go gridlock. You guys say whatever stupid things you want to say, just quit taxing us and spending our money foolishly, and let's get it done at the local level. But how do that was one of the reasons I wanted to leave Washington. Although I love Washington, I don't regret a minute there. I was standing in line at the bookstore with my first grader, and the woman behind me said, in the first day of school, "You were such a bitch on Meet the Press yesterday." My six-year-old grabs my hand like she says, "My mother's going to blow. I know she's going to blow at any minute." I said, and she was right. So I said, I can't be, I'm too much, I got too much of a hair trigger to be around people who say that kind of stuff in front of my kids. So you're right. It's problematic.
I'm going to try to keep the answer short, because this is something that thought about a lot, to get asked about, and there are a lot of different reasons. I'm going to give you one that I think that maybe people hadn't thought of. There's too much information. I teach a class at Tulane. First of all, you got to get in Tulane. We'll have 40 kids, we'll have 350 applicants. And I sit there and I said, you're right here. You have everything, every kind of news outlet, everything. And when I went to LSU in the early 60s, you got the Baton Rouge paper, and if you wanted to read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, you had to go to the library, get it 4 days late, and it was on a stick about that long. All right? And they're no more informed than I was. Now, why is that? And I'll tell you what it is. Because if you're a liberal, you never have to read another thing but a liberal thing in your life. You can pick your TV shows, you can pick your websites, you can pick your magazines. Same thing if you're a conservative. And what's happened is, as a result of all of this information, everything has become validating. Ha ha, I knew I was right. And there's a whole market. People make tens of millions of dollars telling you that what you thought was right. And so that's why there's so much information. And I, the way, you know, it's like people use information the way that a drunk uses a lamppost for support, not illumination. Right?
There's that.
Nobody. So the way that I deal with it with my glass is, I will assign, if I want to do the Keystone Pipeline, I want to do NSA spying. A through L take one position, M through Z take another position. And on the exam, they'll have 10 different positions that they have to know, and they'll have to argue. I'll randomly select, argue in favor of this, argue against that. You don't get to pick. And because it's so, all of this information has made people, if you're, and so everybody is a professional, you just, it becomes, people become narrower and deeper. And so, and they become about this issue and that issue. And I think that that's, and I don't know, I don't know if there's any answer to it. I think we got a pretty, we try with my young people pretty good. But I think that's it. I think when you had a fewer sources of information, but you learned more because everybody kind of read the same thing.
I promise I'm not building a Swiss village here, but it's an important question for this reason. Emerson University did a study some years recently on the whole notion, and they put people in a room and they'd have, you hooked them up to those, whatever those things are that you get hooked up to, and you'd have a conversation, the creative part of their brains were talking. They started political dialogue, debates. The rational parts of their brains went completely black, and the emotional parts went completely red. Well, that's why we have to kind of think about it and work towards resolution, because that's no way to run any government at any level with your brains on fire. There's another more modern that study is not that old, but Jonathan Haidt, Haidt, in that book, The Righteous Mind. You know, there are some brain differences. Like we know the whole Venus Mars things, but the conservative liberal thing, they're just, we should try to understand some other things about it that we haven't typically brought to the debate about why we are such foul mouthed, uncivil people.
Yeah. More questions? How about one way in the back there? Someone has his hand up there. Well, you referenced it, I recognize it. Yeah.
Has big money and gerrymandering destabilized our political system?
Well, I don't, we could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
One of the problems we have is, if you want to do an interesting thing, Google 2012 presidential election results by county. And when you look at a map, you said, my God, how did Obama win? And the truth of the matter is, boys, it's true in Pennsylvania, maybe as much as anywhere. The Democrats live in the city, and some of the suburbs and the Republicans live everywhere else. All right, I'll give you an example. This is my favorite statistic from 2012. If Mitt Romney would have broken even in three counties, he would have won the electoral vote. Broward County, Florida, Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, and Cuyahoga County, Ohio. If he would have just broken even in those three counties. Now, he did. It was almost a four-point election, and it was an electoral college blowout. But, I mean, that gives you the sense of in much more than before, the Democrats have become an urban party, and the Republicans have become a non-urban party. And if you just look at that, and so what happens is, the Democrats actually won the popular vote in the House in 2012. But we win by so much in Philadelphia that, you know, 90%, that it doesn't sort of carry over to something. Some of it is gerrymandering. I agree. And you could do some of it. But don't discount the fact it's probably most people that I've read who I respect say that natural population tendency has as much to do with it as actual gerrymandering. And if you just look at now, I'm going to say Pennsylvania, which I've been known for a long time. When in 1986, the suburbs have changed here. If you got 37% in Chester, Montgomery, Bucks, and Delaware, and you're a Democrat, you could basically win. Now you get 50. A battle. I mean, it's just the whole urban rural thing has just really, really sort of changed, if you will. And some of it is just the way that people cluster.
My issue with gerrymandering is, in addition to that, the diminution of creative ideas. If you're in a safe seat, you know, 85, 90% of these seats are safe, so you don't have to come up with competitive new ideas. But the clustering, which is a consequence of modernity, of mobility, is really it's sadly interesting, and it was President Clinton who brought this first to my attention, and I forget what the statistic is, but it wasn't that long ago that you're in your neighborhood, you'd have, you know, any number of whatever, you know, but now people are totally clustered in the way that James are saying. So they never even, it's not just what they're seeing on TV or what they're choosing to read. They don't even have barbecues. They don't have neighbors. We're self-clustering, which is kind of scary. The money issue is corrosive and corroding, and not in the way that the press talks about it. It's not campaign money. It's the way money is used to lobby for regulations that disadvantage competitors or advantage one interest or another. It is built into our Constitution that we have the right to petition your government, but they are not petitioned openly or transparently. And the more regulation there is, which is all a process of money, that's where the corrosion comes in. And you're not going to fix that with campaign finance reform, which is why they keep talking about politicians are talking about campaign finance reform, because they know that's not going to fix it. But it's very important, those two issues that you raise.
Well, we could go all night on Citizens United, but we're certainly not going to. Let's just get a few more in before wrap up. And over here.
I really miss watching you guys on K Street, your TV show. Did you have a lot of fun doing it?
Yes.
No.
I did. I loved it. I agree on that. I loved it.
But I'll tell you how, and I'll tell you why, because I'm kind of a fastidious, organized, and I had two babies, and I was writing another book, and I had a job. And the way Steven Soderbergh works, and George Clooney, so you show up on Monday. Steven doesn't even show up. George and James show up, and they're sitting on whoopee cushions and telling the kind of jokes that boys who are 13 like to tell. Okay, and I'm like, I've got stuff to... That goes on Tuesday. That goes on Wednesday. On Thursday, Soderbergh says, okay, if you were in this situation, he picks up the Washington Post, because if you two were in real life in this situation, what would you do? And then he just runs the camera. That's like being naked and jumping off a, you know, it's like two. But we only agreed to do it for one season for 13 weeks, and they were in between the oceans, however, oceans 2001, I don't know how many there are. Was it fun to work with those kind of creative people? Yes. Was it avant-garde? Yes. Can I pull it out of my ear like James can and have fun? No.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it, so 10 years now, It's where television went. We just got there a little early, you know, but that's okay. It was fun. It wasn't quite like doing old school, but...
Or the Muppets.
Yeah, the Muppets.
Anybody over here? I see someone right here.
Hi. Earlier you were talking about gridlock, and I wondered what your respective views are about the New Jersey traffic debacle. And
yeah, finally.
Whether
finally.
Whether Chris Christie, whether
I was going to ask that too.
Whether it'll affect his future.
Let me back up. The story that I don't buy, maybe there's something else, is the sort of TV spot. Did you see the new thing?
Yes.
That he was the kind of, I mean, that stuff, when we went through that in New Orleans, and if you look at the facts, that does not, I think that was a legitimate expenditure of that money. And I know that anybody in tourism will tell you the money that BP put up to bring tourism back to that part of the world was very helpful. And if you run a business on the shore, you want effective TV spots. You want to get people coming back. I mean, that's a really kind of an important thing. I would, this other thing, that's the weirdest damn thing I ever seen.
Is it an abusive
I like rough and tumble politics. Guy's not for you. You hold up a project. You hold up an appointment. You don't do this. The idea is you sort of close lanes on the big... and laughing kids in school buses. I mean, good God almighty. I mean, that's like... And I don't mind... I'm so political. I think one of the... If you want to know what's a real problem in Washington, called the problem is, we got rid of earmarks. You had something you could give people. Go to Johnstown. Jack Murtha basically, you know, built the whole federal government there. But I mean... But the point is, you could get a guy, you know, hey, you want this? You know, you got to do something. I mean, the people that were trying to get things done had some power. I really do. I think it was a big mistake. And if you go look at a lot of projects that they did, but I'm all for, you know, I think one of the great movies I've ever seen was Lincoln. And they were out horse trading post offices and stuff. I mean, it was a really good political movie just about how hard it is to get things done. But this is and I don't think we know the whole thing, but like, if you stop and you think about it, I mean, God, it's just like nuts.
Well, you agree with it?
Okay.
You think it's an abuse of power?
All right, we don't talk about policy per se, but we do talk about politics. And he had me laughing so hard yesterday. He goes, I think he should just dress up in one of those toll booth outfits and go run the toll booth. And I totally agreed with him. Then, I mean, of course it's an abusive part, but the idea that the governor would say shut off three lanes of traffic, that's as stupid as people saying Hillary has today's story, Hillary has a hit list, and you keep track of who didn't support you. Guess what? I can remember from 1976 who didn't support George H.W. Bush going into 1980. It's just the way it works. What's interesting to me about the process is how much media attention these two absurd stories are getting, however wonderful it would have been to have seen Governor Christie in a toll booth outfit.
She's not going to bring up Benghazi.
I said I would have had Bridget Ann Kelly clean commodes on the turnpike. I'm sorry, this is a story. I mean, come on, you can't. And the thing about a scandal, I mean, that was, everybody understands it.
In 2 seconds.
Okay, this is not the LIBOR rate, you know what I mean? Some guys, you know, in a bank, London, overnight stuff. The hell were they doing over there, you know? This is not some synthetic derivative. This is like, oh, you don't endorse me, that's it. Everybody's going to wait in traffic before you can't, you literally, so my idea is what, and so now to say Hillary has a hit list, so Hillary has to say, in interest of bipartisanship, I'm going to create a special cabinet position called the Department of Retribution, and Chris Christie is going to be, and he's going to sit there all day and figure out to Shaft. I mean, it's too. And I don't know. I like a little politics. I don't have anything to do with it, you know what I mean? But woo!
He's always like this, right? Didn't he make you laugh around the clock? Can you just the idea of Chris Christie in the toll booth outfit? I couldn't stop.
All right. Well, you guys can argue this out going forward. We're all done here tonight. So thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.